Good morning. You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is John Luke, and I will be reading from the Eagle Tribune. LAB would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Okay, the lead story in the Eagle Tribune. Moulton criticizes ICE over detention of immigrants. ICE denies claims. Editor's note, this story was updated with a statement provided December 2 by the Department of Homeland Security. Burlington, Congressman Moulton is criticizing federal authorities for inhumane conditions at an ICE facility where people are detained on immigration violations or held before being transferred to other locations. On Monday, Moulton conducted an official oversight visit to the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement offices in Burlington that included a tour of the building and meetings with ICE officials. The administrative building is one of 25 ICE enforcement and removal operations facilities across the country. But Moulton, a Democrat from Salem, said little has changed since his June visit to the facility when he raised similar concerns about detainees sleeping on concrete floors with lack of access to adequate food and other necessities. The facilities in there are completely inadequate and inhumane for anyone to be staying here an extended length of time. Moulton told reporters gathered outside the building, it does seem that they are moving people through here more quickly. However, that's not entirely a positive, he pointed out. The consequence of that is they don't have as much time to see lawyers intervene in their cases, Moulton said. He cited the case of Marcelo Gomez da Silva, a high school student who was held for nearly a week at the Burlington facility after being mistakenly arrested on immigration violations. The 18-year-old described sleeping on a cement floor and sharing an open toilet with about 40 other detainees. We don't want people stuck here for a long period of time like Marcelo, but at the same time, we want to give people adequate access to lawyers and to see their cases, Moulton said. In a Tuesday statement, an unmanned spokesman from the Department of Homeland Security disputed Moulton claims, pointing out that ICE's field offices in Burlington is a processing facility, not a detention facility. Any claim that there are subprime conditions at ICE detention centers are false, the spokesman said. In fact, ICE has higher detention standards than most U.S. prisons that hold actual U.S. prisoners, citizens. All detainees are provided with proper meals, medical treatment, and have opportunities to communicate with lawyers and family members. The agency highlighted several criminal aliens recently being processed in Burlington before being transferred to another detention facility, including a Colombian national who the statement was said convicted of smuggling cocaine and a man from El Salvador with a deportation removal order for driving under the influence, hit-and-run, domestic violence, and other criminal charges. ICE facilities have become a focal point for Democratic lawmakers who are criticizing the Trump administration's immigration crackdown and accusing federal authorities of abusing executive power. Many members of Congress have repeatedly been denied access to ICE facilities as they tried to conduct oversight visits, and some have been involved in high-profile clashes with immigration officials. Under federal law, members of Congress can make unannounced oversight visits to immigration facilities that detain immigrants. Lawmakers and their staff must request a visit in most cases up to 72 hours in advance, sometimes longer. The press and public are not allowed on those visits. Last week, U.S. Senator Ed Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, held a rally with protesters outside the Burlington ICE facility where he criticized the Trump administration's crackdown. Moulton, who was challenging Markey in next year's Democratic primary, invited Markey and U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren to join him for Monday's oversight visit. They declined, according to Moulton's office. For weeks, protesters have been camped outside the Burlington facility, a two-story building between a corporate office park and the Burlington Mall off Interstate 95 to criticize ICE and demand federal authorities release undocumented immigrants who say they have not committed any crimes. On Monday, members of a multi-faith Canopies of Compassion campaign marched around the building and sang as Moulton met inside with ICE officials. Emerging from his tour, Moulton said the regular protests have led to changes by federal immigration officials to improve conditions for detainees. The presidency that you have here as Americans standing up for American values absolutely has an impact on what happens behind those doors, he said. ICE has targeted Massachusetts with several high-profile immigration raids, including a recent operation that led to the arrest of more than 1,400, quote, illegal aliens, the agency said, who have criminal records and ties to transnational organized crime gangs. Why am I having trouble believing this? Okay, Republican President Donald Trump signed an executive order in April directing Homeland Security to compile a nationwide list of sanctuary jurisdictions where local law enforcement restricts cooperation with federal immigration agents. Trump's order accuses some state and local officials of engaging in a lawless insurrection against the supremacy of federal law by obstructing U.S. immigration and customs enforcement operations. In September, the U.S. Department of Justice sued Boston over its sanctuary policies limiting cooperation with federal immigration crackdowns, claiming the city government is shielding criminal elements from deportation. The suit challenges provisions of Boston's Trust Act that require police officers to hold information about aliens in city custody who are subject to federal immigration enforcement, including their release date. Governor Maury Healey, a Democrat, has said despite claims by ICE, state, and local enforcement officials aren't allowing dangerous and undocumented criminals to be released into the community. She has also criticized the Trump administration for targeting undocumented immigrants who don't have criminal backgrounds. And let's see, this is from Kristen M. Wade, covers the Massachusetts State House for North of Boston Media Group's newspapers and websites. Okay, next article. Santa Fund in loving memory. The following are today's contributions to the Eagle Tribune Santa Fund. To make a contribution online, visit eagletribunes.com/Santa Fund. In loving memory of Ashley Cohen, who was sadly missed, love Chris, Judy, and Samantha. $50 in loving memory of our Nana, Catherine Higgins, our Uncle Harold Higgins, Aunt Ann Higgins, Aunt Ruth Higgins, our cousins Billy Higgins, and our dear friends Michael McLaughlin and Nancy Ross, who were sadly missed from the McDonald's clan. $20 in loving memory of friends Marty Cashman, Todd Bedlins, and others. And a few other long lists here. Maybe we'll come back to this when we have time. But you know, it's really great that people are contributing to that. Police intend to charge woman who slashed firefighter's face. Andover. A woman will face assault charges for allegedly attacking an Andover firefighter and an ambulance with medical scissors on Monday afternoon. Andover police say they intended to charge a 24-year-old woman with one count of assault and battery with a dangerous weapon and one count of assault and battery on a public employee for the incident. At 12:53 p.m. Monday, Andover police responded to a disturbance call in the alley next to One Elm Square. Police found a mother and a daughter when they arrived and determined the daughter, a 24-year-old female, was having a mental health crisis and a manic episode, Lieutenant Frank Fitzpatrick said. Responding officers called for Andover's fire rescue ambulance to transport the patient to the hospital. Fitzpatrick said the woman appeared calm interacting with the officers before getting in the ambulance. But once the ambulance's doors closed and began driving, Fitzpatrick said it only made it about 50 feet before stopping. Andover police officers went over to the stopped emergency vehicle and determined the woman slashed one of the Andover firefighters in the face with a pair of trauma shears and cut him below his nose as the ambulance was driving away from the scene. The trauma shears were equipment in the ambulance and not carried by the woman, but the scissors were somehow accessible to the patient, police determined. The woman, who has not been identified, was taken to a local hospital to undergo mental health treatment. She will be summoned to appear in Lawrence District Court to be formally charged at a future date when released from psychiatric care. Fitzpatrick said proper mental health assistance was prioritized in this circumstance instead of arresting or arraigning her on the charges while she is in the hospital. While he stressed mental health was at play in the incident, the woman assaulted a firefighter and the charges reflect behavior as not tolerated. Wow, it's good to see our police responding in such a good way. Cedar Foods donates $1 million to search for new YMCA. Haverhill. The vision of a bigger, better YMCA in Haverhill has lingered, but a $1 million gift, an early Christmas present from a hometown business, brings that dream within reach. Cedar Foods donated $1 million to the Haverhill YMCA's capital campaign, becoming the first corporate donor and pushing the group closer to its goal, moving into a new state-of-the-art facility that would dramatically expand services citywide. This was also the Haverhill YMCA's announcement that it is seeking a new location to replace its longtime home at 81 Winter Street. The Y serves about 2,000 members, while the proposed new facility could accommodate up to 17,000, more than eight times as many members. Tracy Fuller, executive director of the Haverhill YMCA, said the existing building no longer meets the needs of the city. We have a 20-yard pool right now we need to build, she said. We would like to build a pool and other facilities that can serve all of Haverhill. Fuller added that the Wise Winter Street location is at capacity. The plans are for the new building to include expanded sports, recreation, and aquatics facilities, an Olympic-sized pool, comprehensive slate of physical and mental wellness programs, an early learning center, and specialized programs for seniors and adults. The YMCA wrote that the project will transform the existing YMCA site into the best and highest use to support the region. Cedar Foods, a longtime supporter of local nonprofits, has partnered with the YMCA since 2019 through food donations and funding for after-school programs that help address food insecurity. We are incredibly grateful for this lead gift and continued partnership from Cedars Food, said Fuller. Cedars has been an active supporter of our YMCA for years, helping us care for families through food programs and community partnerships. Their generous donation, which helps us advance plans for a new YMCA while still in the early phases of our capital campaign, is a true testament to their commitment to Haverhill and to the people we serve. Charles Hanna, CEO of Cedar Foods, said the donation is an investment in the community that has shaped his company. As Haverhill's largest employer with more than 1,000 workers, Cedar Foods operates out of five buildings in Haverhill, spanning more than 500,000 square feet and producing over 300 million pounds of hummus every year. Well, that's a lot of hummus, and it's all good. Haverhill is home, Hannah said, and the people here are family. Supporting the construction of a new YMCA is our way of helping to create opportunities for healthy learning, living, and connection for generations to come. We are proud to contribute to a space that will foster growth, wellness, and belonging for children, families, and seniors alike, and we hope this gift inspires others to join in building a stronger, healthier Haverhill. Site selection and planning for the future YMCA are ongoing, and Fuller said this donation is transformative, a vote of confidence in what's next for the organization. The Haverhill YMCA plans to share project updates and site details in the coming months. For more information or to donate to the capital campaign, contact Fuller T, that's F-U-L-L-E-R-T, at NorthShoreYMCA.org. And if you haven't tried it yet, try Cedar's balsamic vinegar and caramelized onion hummus. It is fabulous. Okay. Are we ready, Susan?
Yes.
Okay. Susan, take it away. I neglected to introduce her earlier, and let her get into the sun.
Thank you. In the sun, education, Lowell's Goodhue, Massachusetts Teacher of the Year. 64th recipient becomes Massachusetts candidate for the National Teacher of the Year Award. In Lowell, there are 80,000 teachers in the Commonwealth, but only one of them is selected as the Teacher of the Year. Out of 200 nominations, Tara Goodhue, a science teacher at Lowell High School, received the honor. She was recognized during a ceremony in the Riddick Athletic Center Tuesday morning. "Thank you for bestowing this incredible honor on me," Goodhue said, specifically calling out Secretary of Education Patrick Tutwiler and Education Commissioner Pedro Martinez during her remarks. "This is an honor for all of us." The Teacher of the Year program is the state's top award for educators and annually recognizes excellence in teaching through the selection of a teacher who exemplifies the dedication, commitment, and positive contributions of educators statewide. The selection process for the 2026 Teacher of the Year began in early 2025 with a call for nominations from administrators, teachers, students, parents, and others. An initial review of each application led to the selection of 8 semi-finalists who then submitted additional supporting material. 4 finalists were selected and interviewed by a panel that included prior Massachusetts Teachers of the Year. That panel then recommended 2 names to Martinez, who made the final decision. He was enthusiastic in his support of Goodhue. "When I first met her, I told her that I wish I would have had a science teacher like her when I was growing up," he told a reporter before the ceremony. "She is a science teacher who brings her students out to nature and helps them to understand their environment." State and local leadership attended the event, including state reps Vanna Howard, Rodney Elliott, and Tara Hogg, Lowell Public Schools Superintendent Liam Skinner, and school committee-elect Danielle McFadden. McFadden, a first-time candidate and president of the Greater Lowell Chamber of Commerce, won one of the 2 at-large seats in the November general election. Her 3 children attend Lowell Public Schools, and McFadden called Goodhue's selection a tremendous and well-deserved honor. "Dr. Goodhue represents the very best of Lowell Public Schools, and her work is shaping not just classrooms, but the lives and futures of countless young people," McFadden said by text following the ceremony. "I'm incredibly grateful for teachers like her who inspire our community and elevate our entire district." A packed gymnasium of students, colleagues, and administrative staff gave Goodhue a rousing welcome when Tutwiler called her to the podium. Also in the audience was Goodhue's family, including her father, William, whom she credited with being her first teacher. "My dad who gave me my love of science," she said. Goodhue also gave an emotional remembrance to her late mother, Kathleen Goodhue, who taught French at Lowell High. "She instilled her passion for teaching and her love for Lowell students in me," she said. "I feel her every day when I'm here." David Morales, the general manager with WellPoint, the largest health care plan for state and municipal employees, and government relations director Michael Vasquez, presented Goodhue with a check for $10,000 for the science department. "On a personal level, this means a lot to me," Morales said. "I came here from Puerto Rico, and teachers showed me the way. They became my second parents." The science department, of which Goodhue is now head, had already made plans for some of the funds, and she invited Morales and his team to see the baby turtles through a New England conservation program on Thursday. "Stop by to meet the turtles," she said. WellPoint partnered with the Department of Education and the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education to present funds to the Teacher of the Year program. "This check is to support the people in the classroom to support our next generation," Morales said. The recognition of public school teachers was particularly gratifying to United Teachers of Lowell Corresponding Secretary Mickey Dumont, who attended with Brant Duncan, the Secretary Treasurer of the American Federation of Teachers, Massachusetts. "I have two granddaughters who have gone through the Lowell Public Schools," Dumont said. "One graduated in 2019. She is a registered nurse now at Boston Children's Hospital. The second one is a senior here. She's going into engineering. I cannot say enough great things about the education the kids get in Lowell Public Schools." After the event, Goodhue said she couldn't wait to get back to class and keep learning with her students. "Being able to spend time with the best kids in the state makes me look forward to coming to work every day and has given my life meaning in ways that are difficult to articulate," she said. Goodhue is the 64th recipient of this award and automatically becomes Massachusetts' candidate for the National Teacher of the Year Award. Before coming to Lowell High in 2022, she worked at Greater Lowell Technical High School in Tyngsborough for 14 years. Goodhue holds a Doctor of Education in Leadership in Schools with a STEM concentration from UMass Lowell, a Master of Education in Curriculum and Instruction in Secondary Education, also from UMass Lowell, and a Bachelor of Arts in Biology with a minor in Music Performance from Clark University in Worcester. In 2020, the National Association of Biology Teachers named her Environmental Educator of the Year. Over the coming year, Goodhue will have speaking opportunities within Massachusetts and will travel to California and Washington, D.C. to meet with Teachers of the Year from the rest of the nation. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. There was a discontinuity from the Santa Fund article, and it was mentioned that there were $27,263 in donations and also a section on how to give. Donations may be sent by mail or in person and are accepted in cash, check, MasterCard, Visa, Discover, or American Express. Visit eagletribune.com/SantaFund. Donations can also be mailed to Merrimack Valley YMCA, care of Santa Fund, 280 Merrimack Street, Suite 500, Lawrence, Mass., 01843. Okay, about Bellissini Academy. Bellissini Academy is a middle school for grades 5 through 8, and its tuition is free. Our academic program is designed to spark curiosity, build confidence, and prepare students for future success. So head of school, Aliei Silvero Belkis. With our small class sizes, students receive individualized attention and encouragement to think critically, solve problems, and explore new ideas. The school provides a rigorous curriculum in core subjects, literature, math, science, and social studies, while also emphasizing enrichment in the arts, technology, and languages. The goal, said Belkis, is to send their students to the best private schools in the area. Parents and caregivers invest in their child's education through their family partnership program, contributing more than 2,000 hours of volunteer service each year. Our belief is the FP program strengthens the connection between school and home, building a true community of support, said Belkis. If you'd like to donate, go to the school's website at www.bellincacademy.org/donate. And that is spelled BELLESINI academy.org. Susan.
Thank you, John Luke. Back to the Sun in Southbridge. Court tosses search in alleged drug bust. Finds expanding search into second floor on a first floor warrant unconstitutional. An appeals court is allowing evidence to be tossed from a case against an alleged marijuana dealer, ruling that cops conducted an unconstitutional search. The drug and gun case against Barry Hansen goes back to July of 2023, when police in central Massachusetts executed a search warrant at his first floor apartment. Southbridge police found several guns, packaging materials for the alleged sale, and distribution of marijuana. A large amount of edible products suspected to contain THC and pre-rolled cigarettes packed for sale suspected to be marijuana. Hansen did not have a license to carry firearms and was not licensed by the Cannabis Control Commission to sell marijuana in Massachusetts, as police arrested him on numerous charges. But after his arraignment, Hansen pushed to toss out some of the evidence that was found during the police's search. He argued that the cops should not have gone to the second floor during the search based on the warrant for the first floor. He claimed this violated the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution and Article 14 of the Massachusetts Declaration of Rights. A Superior Court judge agreed with Hansen, allowing his motion to suppress evidence from the search. Prosecutors then called on a higher court to reverse the ruling. During the execution of the warrant for Hansen's first floor apartment, the cops found out that he also rented the second floor apartment and that he was using the two apartments as a single dwelling. This led to police expanding their search to the second floor apartment without obtaining a new warrant. The judge decided that the search of the second floor exceeded the scope of the search warrant approved by the clerk magistrate and therefore allowed the motion to suppress. The state appeals court wrote in its ruling issued on Tuesday, "In sum, when police extended their search to the second floor apartment without obtaining a second warrant, they conducted an unconstitutional search." The appeals court later wrote, "Therefore, the judge correctly concluded that the fruits of that search should be suppressed." The affidavit supporting the search warrant noted several sales of marijuana and related paraphernalia to an undercover cop. Police also reported that they spotted Hansen leaving the first floor with the plastic bags and shoebox from which he later retrieved the drugs that he allegedly sold to the undercover cop. When police executed the search warrant for the first floor, his girlfriend told the cops that Hansen rented both the first and second floor apartments, treating them as a single unit. Associate Justice Catherine Hand, in a dissenting opinion, argued that the search was legal. She wrote that the second floor apartment was part and parcel of the same dwelling identified in the search warrant. Hand wrote, "Because on this record and on these particular facts, I believe that the search the police conducted of the second floor apartment was within constitutional bounds. I respectfully dissent." Back to you, Jean-Luc.
Thank you, Susan. Breakfast with Santa, Haverhill. Haverhill Lions Club presents Breakfast with Santa from 8:30 to 11:30 a.m. on Saturday, December 6th at Maria's Family Restaurant, 81 Essex Street. Admission is $5 per person, which includes entry, breakfast, and an opportunity to take a picture with Santa. Tickets will be sold at the door, and the Haverhill Lions Club will accept Visa, MasterCard, American Express, and Discover cards. All proceeds will benefit Haverhill Lions Club charities. Guests are also asked to bring gently used kids and adults winter coats and jackets for the Coach for Kids drive. No vests or fleece. For more information, call 978-374-2268 or visit haverhilllionsclub.org. Spend the holidays at Nevin's Library, Methuen. Stop by Nevin's Library at 305 Broadway this December for a holiday movie night for the family. Catch a holiday movie matinee where the library will be playing the best Christmas pageant ever at 11 a.m. on Thursday, December 16th. That's a great story. The 2024 film, based on the book by Barbara Robinson, tells the story of a family full of unruly children that visits church one day, Sunday, and takes over the annual Christmas pageant. Register for a spot for the event at nevinslibrary.org. Also, Nevin's Library will be closed December 24th, Thursday, December 25th, Wednesday, December 31st at 3 p.m., and Thursday, January 1st, the library will reopen at regular hours again from 9 to 5 on Friday, January 2. Call Nevin's Library at 978-686-4080 for more information. Choose and cut Christmas trees. Haverhill, Turkey Hill Farm is letting folks choose and cut their own Christmas trees from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays at 380 Middle Road. The farm will be open every weekend until it is sold out of trees. We have lots of beautiful Christmas trees and hope to be open until close on Christmas, according to a notice posted online. Their Douglas fir was awarded Best in Show at the Topsfield Fair this year, with many trees standing up to 9 feet tall. There are also many Fraser firs, which won a first place trophy at Topsfield Fair, up to 10 feet tall this year. The blue spruces also won a blue ribbon and are mostly around 7 feet. These measurements were collected on October 4. All trees, regardless of size, are $120 plus sales tax. The only exceptions are trees that the farm chooses to mark down. Some will be marked with a price tag as low as $10. The farm will be busy on its opening weekend, so tree hunters are recommended to bring their own saw. No chainsaws are allowed. Call 978-372-9474 for more information. Susan.
Thank you, John Luke. Back to the Sun, Massachusetts. Man goes on trial in death of wife who disappeared more than 2 years ago. The Associated Press, Dedham, Mass. Prosecutors Monday argued a Massachusetts man was responsible for the grisly murder of his wife, who disappeared more than 2 years ago, while his lawyers insisted the man panicked after she suddenly died in bed. Anna Walsh, a real estate agent who immigrated from Serbia, was last seen early on January 1, 2023, following a New Year's Eve dinner at her Massachusetts home. Her body has never been found. Her husband, Brian Walsh, faces a first-degree murder charge after agreeing to plead guilty last month to lesser charges of misleading police and willfully disposing of a human body in violation of state law. We will prove the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of the premeditated murder of his wife, Anna Walsh, Assistant Director Attorney Gregory Connor said in his opening statement, adding that among the evidence presented were Brian Walsh's extensive internet search that implicated him in her death and items including a hacksaw and hatchet. Walsh's attorney, Larry Tipton, argued this was not a case of murder, but what he called a sudden, unexplained death of Anna Walsh. He portrayed a couple who loved each other and were planning for the future before Anna Walsh died after celebrating New Year's Eve with her husband and a friend. When he entered the bedroom and began to get into bed, he sensed something was wrong. "You will hear evidence that it made no sense to him," Tipton told the jury. He nudged Anna, his wife. She didn't respond. He nudged her again a little harder. She didn't respond. He nudged her now in a panicked and frantic reaction to where she actually rolled off the bed. Internet searches implicate Walsh. Prosecutors have said that starting on the day of Anna Walsh's disappearance and for several days after, Brian Walsh made multiple online searches on iPhones, iPads, and MacBook at his house, including for dismemberment and best ways to dispose of a body, how long before a body starts to smell, and hacksaw best tool to dismember. Connor also said investigators turned searches on the MacBook that also included best way to dispose of a body, how long for someone missing to inherit, how long missing to be dead, and can you throw away body parts? There was also an article titled, "Is it possible to clean DNA off a knife? A search for best way to dispose of body parts after murder," as well as numerous websites and searches on the computer that dealt with cleaning blood with ammonia, bleach, and hydrogen peroxide. When questioned by investigators, Walsh said his wife had been called to Washington, D.C. from Massachusetts on New Year's Day for a work emergency. He didn't contact her employer until January 4. The company, the first to notify police that Anna Welsh was missing, said there was no emergency, prosecutors said. Items found with Anna Welsh's DNA. Investigators said surveillance video showed a man resembling Welsh throwing what appeared to be heavy trash bags into a dumpster not far from their home, and that a search of a trash processing facility near his mother's home uncovered bags that contained a hatchet, hammer, shears, hacksaw, towels, and a protective Tyvek suit, cleaning agents, a Prada purse, boots like the ones Anna Welsh was last seen wearing, and a COVID-19 vaccination card with her name. Connor told the jury that the Massachusetts State Crime Laboratory examined some of the items for DNA against samples they had from the couple. They found Anna and Brian Walsh's DNA on the Tyvek suit and Anna Walsh's DNA on the hatchet, hacksaw, and other items. No one has seen her since her husband said she left on January 1st, Connor said. She has not accessed her finances, her email. Her phone has made no calls, and no one has found her body. Prosecutors have also said that Anna Welsh had taken out $2.7 million in life insurance, naming her husband as the sole beneficiary. The couple, who have three young children, now in state custody, lived in the affluent coastal community of Cohasset, about 15 miles, 24 kilometers southeast of Boston. Fraud case weighed on Welsh family. At the time, Welsh was at home awaiting sentencing in an unrelated art fraud case involving the sale of two fake Andy Warhol paintings. Tipton acknowledged the case had put a lot of stress on the couple's marriage, but argued that Brian Welsh's reaction the night of his wife's death was driven by efforts to protect his three boys. He never thought anybody would believe that Anna Welsh was alive one minute and dead the next, Tipton said. All he could think about was those three boys. What would happen to their three boys now that Anna is no longer here? What will happen if they think he did something bad to Anna? Where will those three boys go? He was ultimately sentenced this year to more than 3 years behind bars and ordered to pay $475,000 in restitution. Credibility questions with state police. The trial's outcome could be impacted by potential witnesses from the Massachusetts State Police, including Michael Proctor, who was the lead investigator on the Karen Reed case. Reed, who was found not guilty of charges in the death of her boyfriend, filed a lawsuit this month accusing members of the Massachusetts State Police and several others, including Proctor, of targeting her and shielding the real killers. The former state trooper was fired after sharing offensive and sexist texts about Reed with friends, family, and coworkers. During the second trial, Reed's defense attorney, Alan Jackson, argued Proctor's blatant bias tainted every aspect of the corrupt and flawed investigation. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. That's pretty gruesome. Okay, Lawrence, after 4 months as interim leader, Holly House has been officially named executive director and CEO of the Psychological Center, a city nonprofit that assists those experiencing homelessness, addiction, and mental health challenges. House took the helm at TPC in August after the abrupt departure of Karina Papalardo, its former chief executive officer. Papalardo has a pending lawsuit against TPC alleging breach of contract and violations of the state's wage law. The TPC Board of Directors announced Howe's appointment and a statement released Monday night. The center has been providing mental health and recovery services in Greater Lawrence since 1971. The organization runs the Daybreak Homeless Shelter and Women's View and Pegasus Recovery Homes, all in Lawrence. This decision reflects the board's confidence in Holly's leadership, integrity, and commitment to the mission of TPC. Hawley has been successfully leading the organization in interim capacity since August 2025, providing steady guidance and a clear strategic vision during a period of transition, according to the statement. Stepping into the role, Hawley has placed a strong emphasis on preserving and advancing TPC's mission while instilling the core values that define our work: compassion, accountability, collaboration, and client-centered service. Her focus on operational excellence, staff development, and strengthening community partnerships has already brought renewed stability and momentum to the organization. The board looks forward to continuing to work closely with Hawley as she leads the Psychological Center into its next chapter of growth, innovation, and service to the community, according to the TPC statement. Reached Tuesday, Penny Hamill, president of the TPC Board of Directors, said Howe's appointment moves forward a refreshed brand identity and reflects this new chapter. As part of this effort, we have launched a new official Facebook page where TPC is committed to showcasing the vital work we do to support individuals in recovery and those experiencing homelessness in our community. We'll also be launching a new website in the near future. Our platforms emphasize transparency, community engagement, and storytelling that honors the resilience of the people we serve. We remain dedicated to upholding our core values, including being open and accountable about the programs we offer, the impact we make, and how donations are used to support our mission, Hamill said. She said Howe has many attainable goals for TPC, and we have no doubt that, along with her leadership and the positive feedback we had received from the community on her impact so far, TPC will continue to move forward with strength, clarity, and purpose. Her vision aligns closely with TPC's commitment to serving our community with passion, integrity, and innovation. House has a strong background in leadership, change management, and organizational development. She is recognized for her people-first philosophy and commitment to building strong collaborative teams, officials said last summer. Papalardo, TPC Chief Executive Officer for more than 10 years, was removed from her role on August 6th. She received a letter terminating her employment effective immediately, according to a lawsuit filed in Essex Superior Court on August 29. The suit names TPC Hamill and Vice President Luz Frazier. Papalardo's August 6th termination letter was a final paycheck, which included amounts for unused vacation time. Lawsuit disputes the amount of unused vacation time Papalardo had accrued. The lawsuit seeks damages for Papalardo and other similarly situated TPC employees, according to the suit. Papalardo knows of at least five or more current employees who were not paid within 7 days of the end of the pay period, and or former employees who voluntarily left employment with the Psychological Center affected by Psychological Center unlawful conduct since August 26, 2022. The court has asked to grant Papalardo actual damages plus triple damages plus costs, statutory interest, and reasonable attorney fees. Responses to the lawsuit are due in court on December 19, according to court records. Since stepping into the role, Hawley has placed a little bit of editing error. Susan.
Thank you, Jean-Luc. Back to the Sun. Flooding. More than 1,300 dead in Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and Thailand. The Associated Press. Emergency crews raced to reach survivors and recover more bodies Tuesday as the death toll from last week's catastrophic floods and landslides surged past 1,300 in Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and Thailand, with nearly 900 people missing. Days of heavy monsoon rains inundated vast areas, leaving thousands stranded and many clinging to rooftops and trees waiting for help. The flooding and landslides killed at least 1,338 people, 744 people in Indonesia, 410 people in Sri Lanka, 181 people in Thailand, and 3 in Malaysia, authorities said Tuesday. Sri Lanka's president, Anura Kumarasinghe, said it's too early to determine the exact number of dead in his country. In Indonesia, the hardest-hit nation, rescuers struggle to access villages on Sumatra Island where roads have been washed out and bridges collapsed. At least 551 people remain missing, according to the country's National Disaster Management Agency. Helicopters and boats have been deployed, but officials warn that worsening weather and damaged infrastructure are slowing operations. Indonesia's forest in ruins. Floods and landslides in North Sumatra carried away millions of cubic meters of felled timber, officials said, sparking public concern that illegal logging may have contributed to the disaster. Batang Toru, the lush forested area, has turned into a wasteland of broken logs and shattered homes. Roads have vanished, replaced by rivers of sludge. This is not just a natural disaster, it's a man-made crisis, said Rianada Purba from the Indonesian Environmental Forum, an activist group. Deforestation and unchecked development have stripped Batang Toru of its resilience. Without urgent restoration and stricter protections, these floods will become the new normal. Survivors desperately search for their loved ones. A week after flash floods and landslides swept through West Sumatra, survivors were still awaiting news of their loved ones. Zahari Sutra held photos of his missing wife and two daughters, aged 4 and 2, as he pleaded for help with rescuers in Sikambang village in Agam district. Other victims have been found. Why not my family? The 38-year-old farmer said he dropped his motorbike and ran for higher ground when rising waters blocked his path to home last Thursday. He said the raging current swallowed his home. He waded through the water, shouting for his wife and daughters, but there was only silence. As darkness fell, he found his eldest, a 5-year-old girl, covered in mud but safe. Fearing more floods, Sutra clung to a lychee tree with his daughter until dawn. When the full scope of the disaster was revealed, all homes were gone or buried under tons of mud. I carried my daughter and went for help, he said, his voice breaking. My only prayer is to find my wife and children. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres expressed his condolences for victims' families on Tuesday and said the UN is in close contact with authorities in all 4 countries and stands ready to support relief and response efforts, according to spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric. Sri Lanka counts the dead and Thailand begins cleanup. Military-led rescue teams in Sri Lanka scoured flood-devastated areas for 336 people still missing in the aftermath of Cyclone Dittwa, the Disaster Management Center said Tuesday. Roads were blocked by landslides and bridges have collapsed, making access difficult. In the central city of Kandy, residents struggled without running water, relying instead on bottled water collected from natural springs. Authorities warned that conditions could worsen as more rain is forecast in the coming days. President Dzinayake, speaking in a meeting with government officials, described the disaster as the worst to strike the country in recent history, saying it remains impossible to determine the full scale of casualties. He warned that the death toll is likely far higher than current figures. He said that government agencies were working to reach isolated communities. Saladure Yogaraj, 35, a resident of Sarasavagama, said he lost his entire family, mother, wife, and 2 children. I can't even think what life is going to be like, he said. Another man, Durekanu Moharharan, said he lost his wife, daughter, and a house. Only my sons and I survived. Now I am staying with my brother, he said. At least 3 people were confirmed dead in Malaysia after floods left stretches of northern Perlis state underwater, authorities said. About 6,000 people sought shelter in emergency centers. In southern Thailand, Cleanup has begun on streets and in buildings after massive floods affecting more than 1.5 million households and 3.9 million people. Authorities are working to restore infrastructure, including water and electricity. Thailand's Interior Ministry said Monday it would set up public kitchens to provide freshly cooked food to affected residents. The first batch of compensation payments of 239 million baht, $7.4 million, is set to be distributed to 26,000 people. Government spokesperson Sirapong Angasakyat also said Monday. Pakistan and India spar over in-flight permission. Pakistan on Tuesday accused India of blocking a military aircraft carrying humanitarian aid to Sri Lanka, an allegation New Delhi swiftly rejected. Pakistan's foreign ministry said a Pakistan Air Force transport plane had been delayed for more than 60 hours while waiting for India to clear its route through Indian airspace. It said India withheld overflight permission, then issued what Islamabad called an operationally impractical clearance late Sunday that was valid for only a few hours and did not include a return route. Indian officials rejected Pakistan's allegations as baseless, saying they approved the overflight request within 4 hours on humanitarian grounds. Airspace restrictions between India and Pakistan have been in place since April, after a deadly attack in disputed Kashmir triggered a brief 4-day conflict before a ceasefire was reached. Karmini reported from Jakarta, Indonesia, and Associated Press journalists. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. This is all part of a New Hampshire in a Minute section. Winter parking ban reminders. Hampstead. Hampstead's winter parking ban is now in effect until April 1. Parking on any town roads, day or night, is prohibited. This includes the end of cul-de-sacs and the apron of driveways that extend into roadways. Residents are also asked to remove the following items from their streets / right-of-way for the duration of the parking ban: trailers and campers, portable basketball hoops, trash / recycling bins after pickup, hockey nets, and other sporting equipment. Vehicles and items left in the roadway are subject to towing or removal at the owner's expense. Salem. Beginning November 15 and extending through April 15, vehicles are not allowed to park on any roadway between 12 a.m. and 6 a.m. or during any declared snow emergency. To be safe when it snows, don't park on the street. Violators can be ticketed and or towed. Watershed Management Public Hearing Postponed, Salem. A public hearing held by the town to discuss a watershed management plan for Captain's Pond was postponed from December 1 to December 9 due to inclement weather. The meeting will be held from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the Town Hall, 33 Guermonte Drive. Residents are encouraged to attend and provide feedback on how to best tackle water quality and cyanobacteria concerns within the watershed. Winter Book Fair, Wyndham. The Friends of the Wyndham Library will hold its annual Winter Book Fair during select times December 3 through December 6 at the Nesmith Library, 8 Fellows Road. Come support the local library and peruse a large selection of children's and adult books and media, including games and puzzles. From 11 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. on December 3, teachers, Friends of the Wyndham Library members, and senior citizens are invited to the library for a special preview of items for sale. The book fair will be open to the public 11 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. on December 4, 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. on December 5, and 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on December 6. The $5 bag of book sale will also take place from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. on December 6. Santa Claus to arrive by helicopter at Aviation Museum, Londonderry. Kids and families are welcome to meet St. Nick in person during a 2-hour midday stopover beginning at 11 a.m. on December 13 at the Aviation Museum, 27 Navigator Road. Families wishing to welcome, I'm sorry, lost my place. Families willing to welcome the arrival of Santa's helicopter should be at the museum no later than 10:45 to park and make their way to the landing observation area. After arriving, Santa will enter the museum where he'll visit with families and fans until 1 p.m. and then he'll depart by fire truck courtesy of the Manchester Airport Fire Department. Children who speak to Santa will be rewarded with a goodie bag given out by Santa's helpers. Santa's visit is rain or shine. If the weather prevents Santa's chopper from flying, he'll arrive by the Manchester Airport fire truck instead. Susan.
Thank you, Jean-Luc. Back to the sun in Europe. Putin accuses Europeans of sabotaging peace efforts. Russian President Vladimir Putin accused Kyiv's European allies Tuesday of sabotaging U.S.-led efforts to end the nearly four-year-old war in Ukraine. They don't have a peace agenda. They're on the side of the war, Putin said, after speaking to an investment forum and before he met in the Kremlin with a U.S. delegation led by Envoy Steve Witkoff and President Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Putin's accusations appear to be his latest attempt to sow dissension between Trump and European countries and set the stage for exempting Moscow from blame for any lack of progress. He accused Europe of amending peace proposals with demands that are absolutely unacceptable to Russia, thus blocking the entire peace process only to blame Russia for it. That's their goal, Putin said. He reiterated his long-held position that Russia has no plans to attack Europe, a concern regularly voiced by some European countries. But if Europe suddenly wants to wage a war with us and starts it, we are ready right away. There can be no doubt about that, Putin said. Russia started the war in 2022 with its full-scale invasion of a sovereign European country, and European governments have since spent billions of dollars to support Ukraine financially and militarily, to wean themselves from energy dependence on Russia, and to strengthen their own militaries to deter Moscow from seizing more territory by force. They worry that if Russia gets what it wants in Ukraine, it will have free rein to threaten or disrupt other European countries, which already have faced incursions from Russian drones and fighter jets and an alleged widespread Russian sabotage campaign. Trump's peace plan relies on Europe to provide the bulk of the financing and security guarantees for a post-war Ukraine, even though no Europeans appear to have been consulted on the original plan. That's why European governments have pushed to ensure that peace efforts address European concerns too. Speaking with Putin via a translator before the talks, Witkoff said he and Kushner had taken a beautiful walk around Moscow and described it as a magnificent city. Coinciding with Witkoff's trip, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky went to Ireland, continuing his visits to European countries that have helped sustain his country's fight against Russia's invasion. High-stakes negotiations. In what could be a high-stakes day of negotiations, Zelensky said he was expecting swift reports later in the day from the U.S. envoys in Moscow on whether talks could move forward. After Trump's initial 28-point plan was whittled down to 20 in Sunday's talks between U.S. and Ukrainian officials in Florida. They want to report right after that meeting to us specifically. The future and the next steps depend on these signals. Such steps will change throughout today, even hour by hour, I believe, Zelensky said at a news conference in Dublin with Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin. If the signals show fair play with our partners, we then might meet very soon. Meet with the American delegation, he said. There is a lot of dialogue, but we need results. Our people are dying every day, Zelensky said. I am ready to meet with President Trump. It all depends on today's talks. Building on progress in Florida. After months of frustration in his efforts to stop the fighting, Trump deployed officials to get traction for his peace proposals. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Putin's talks with Witkoff and Kushner would take as long as needed. The talks have followed parallel lines so far, with the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio sitting down with Ukrainian officials. Zelensky said he met Tuesday with a Ukrainian delegation that returned from the negotiations with U.S. representatives in Florida. Rubio said those talks made progress, but added that there's more work to be done. Zelensky said the Florida talks took as their cue a document that both sides drafted at an earlier meeting in Geneva. The Ukrainian leader said that document was now finalized, although he didn't explain what that meant. Ukrainian diplomats are working to ensure that European partners are substantially involved in decision-making, Zelensky said on the Telegram messaging app, and warned about what he said were Russian disinformation campaigns aimed at steering the negotiations. Ukrainian intelligence will provide partners with the information we have about Russia's true intentions and its attempts to use diplomatic efforts as cover to ease sanctions and block important collective European decisions, Zelensky said. European leaders want a say. Zelensky met with political leaders and lawmakers in Dublin on his first official visit. Ireland is officially neutral and isn't a member of NATO, but has sent non-lethal military support to Ukraine. More than 100,000 Ukrainians have moved to Ireland since Russia launched its war on February 24, 2022. Though this week's consultations can move the process forward, few details have become public. It remains unclear how envoys are going to bridge the gap between the two sides on such basic differences as who keeps what territory. European officials say the road to peace will be long. European leaders are trying to figure out how they can make their voices heard after being largely sidelined by Washington. They are also working on future security guarantees for Ukraine. Zelensky was in Paris on Monday, and French President Emmanuel Macron said they spoke by phone with Witkoff. They also spoke to leaders of eight other European countries, as well as top European Union officials and NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. Macron said the coming days will see crucial discussions between U.S. officials and Western partners. Zelensky's visit to Paris followed Sunday's meeting between Ukrainian and U.S. officials, which Rubio described as productive. Diplomats face a hard time trying to bridge Russian and Ukrainian differences and persuading them to strike compromises. The key obstacles over whether Kyiv should cede land to Moscow and how to ensure Ukraine's future security appear unresolved. Zelensky under pressure. Zelensky is under severe pressure in one of the darkest periods of the war for his country. As well as managing diplomatic pressure, he must find money to keep Ukraine afloat, address a corruption scandal that has reached the top echelons of his government, and keep Russia at bay on the battlefield. The Kremlin late Monday claimed that Russian forces have captured the key city of Pokrovsk in the Donetsk region of eastern Ukraine. Zelensky, however, said in Paris that fighting was still ongoing in Pokrovsk on Monday. Ukraine's general staff on Tuesday also denied Russia's claims to have captured Pokrovsk, saying it was a propaganda stunt. The Ukrainian army is readying additional logistics routes to deliver supplies to troops in the area, the Facebook post said. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. I think we should take our mid-show break now. Okay, we're back from our break. You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. LAB, we would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio link that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. All right, continuing in the Eagle Tribune. Hagrid's retirement averts discipline decision after DWI charge. Derry. Sean Hagrid's retirement from the Derry Fire Department after 23 years spares town officials from deciding his fate following an October arrest and months on paid administrative leave. He has chosen to resign relative to an action we would have taken, said town administrator Michael Fowler. Hagrid, 48, of Chester, was put on leave October 20, just 2 days after he was stopped by police in Bow and arrested on suspicion of driving while intoxicated. Bow police confirmed to news outlets. At the time of his arrest, Hagrid was driving a department-owned emergency vehicle. The following day, Hagrid notified the town of the incident and was immediately put on paid leave, Fowler said. On Monday, he retired from his position as chief, effective immediately. In general, Hagrid had the opportunity to take the option to retire based on the number of years he worked for the town, Fowler said. Since he has retired, that now allows the town to go forward and reset with an interim fire chief. As a part of any employee's rights, Hagrid remained on the payroll with no decrease to his salary or access to his benefits when he was put on paid leave, Fowler said. At the time of his retirement, he was making around $155,000 a year and is now eligible to collect his pension. However, placing Hagrid on paid leave caused scrutiny from some residents who questioned taxpayer equity, Fowler said. Paid leave is not designed to be a permanent status for anybody, but in this case, it was a fairly quick adjudication on that end, and ultimately Hagrid decided to take retirement, which puts the town in the direction to move forward, Fowler said. This is a fairly unusual event for the town, so it was an appropriate use of the paid leave to flesh out exactly where this was going to go. Just after 12:30 a.m. on October 18, Hagrid was stopped near the intersection of Route 3A and Carriage Row in Bow after he was observed swerving over the center and fog lines, weaving in side-swiping brush off the road, the officer wrote in his report. The officer said that immediately upon stopping Hagrid, he smelled a strong odor of alcohol under open and empty containers of beer in the vehicle. Though Hagrid admitted to drinking earlier in the night, he denied drinking while driving. Sean's speech also sounded slurred, and he was speaking slowly, and his eyes were watery/glossy, the police report show. Based on my observations, I asked Sean how much he had to drink. Sean admitted he consumed 4 alcoholic beverages earlier in the night. Hagrid agreed to field sobriety tests, which he failed, and was subsequently arrested and charged with driving while intoxicated. He was released on personal reconnaissance pending an arraignment on November 20, where he pleaded no contest and was ordered to pay a fine of $620 and attend an impaired driving education program. Additional, Hart's driving license was suspended for 9 months. Hagrid was sworn in as chief on March 1, 2024, but was with the department for nearly 2 decades. During his time with the Derry Fire Department, he contributed a lot of time to the safety of the town, Fowler said. As chief, Hagrid was instrumental in trying to institute change, launch initiatives at the department, and manage the looming opening of a new fire station. It's bittersweet, but obviously had his own personal reasons for his retirement, Fowler said. He was a trusted employee here for 23 years. He was with us. From the town's perspective, we wish him and his family well in their future endeavors. On Tuesday night, during a town council meeting, Acting Chief Greg Laro was named as interim chief. Prior to Hagrid's leave, Laro was in the position of assistant chief. In the coming months, the town will start the search for a permanent fire chief replacement. Susan.
Thank you, John Luke. Back to the Sun, the 5-minute read. Holiday event for incarcerated individuals in Chelmsford. The second annual holiday event at the Middlesex Sheriff's Office Training Academy on November 22 was hosted by the MSO's Family Support Services Unit for the families of incarcerated individuals. The holiday event featured activities with staff from the Discovery Museum in Acton, balloon animals crafted by retired MSO Captain Drew Crawford, and cookie decorating. Additionally, each family was given a turkey donated by the Manoli's Family Foundation, fresh eggs from the MSO's Project Earth, and cookies baked by the MSO's culinary staff. The Wish Project from Chelmsford and the MSO's religious services staff also provided gifts that were distributed to children attending the event. The event also featured a raffle of two bicycles donated by the family of an individual previously incarcerated at Billerica's Middlesex Jail and House of Correction. The family donated the bicycles as a thank you for the support they had received while their loved ones was incarcerated. I am incredibly grateful to our team, the Manolis family, the Wish Project, and the Discovery Museum for making this event such an overwhelming success, Sheriff Peter Koutagian said. Speaking to so many of the families who came, it was powerful to hear not just how much today meant to them, but how impactful their experiences with our Family Support Services Unit team are throughout the year. Through the MSO's partnership with the Wish Project, the group is working with the FSSU team to sponsor 40 families of individuals in the MSO's lower security programs, community work, work release, and pre-release. Parents will also be able to give these presents directly to their children during upcoming visits. To learn more about the Middlesex Sheriff's Office and the Family Support Services Unit, please visit middlesexsheriff.org. In Tewksbury, movie time. Catch a showing of Freakier Friday on Friday, December 5 from 2 to 4 p.m. in the meeting room of the Tewksbury Public Library, 300 Chandler Street. This PG-rated comedy is a sequel to the 2003 film about a mother and daughter who inadvertently switch bodies through the magic of Chinese fortune cookies, starring Jamie Lee Curtis, Lindsay Lohan, and Julia Butters. Family comedy rated PG. Doors open at 1:45 p.m. Candy and water will be served. A $1 donation is suggested. Registration is required. Sponsored by the Friends of the Library and Tewksbury Lions Club. For more information, call 978-640-4490 or visit tewksburypl.org. In Lowell, New England Tenors to perform holiday concert. The New England Tenors perform a holiday concert at the Immaculate Conception Church on Sunday, December 7th, from 2 to 4 p.m., 144 East Merrimack Street. The event is open to the public. Tenors John Middleton Cox, Damian Corcoran, and Ethan Bremer will be joined by special guest soprano Celeste Pellegrino, performing a program of solos, duets, and medleys of holiday classics and inspirational music. A free will offering will be accepted at the door to benefit the Immaculate Conception Parish. No reservations are required. The concert is handicap accessible and also offers free parking. For more information, call the IC Parish office at 978-458-1474 or visit iclowell.org. In Westford, save the date, a Charlie Brown Christmas. The Parish Center for the Arts presents its annual jazz concert, a Charlie Brown Christmas, in two performances on Saturday, December 20 at 4 and 7 p.m. Aidan Schrigmiger leads a jazz trio in a performance of Vince Guaraldi's Grammy Award-winning quadruple platinum soundtrack. Tickets are $20 for members, $25 for the public, and $10 for youth under age 12. Lap sitters and carrier kids are free. Seating is cabaret style. Ticket holders should bring their own food and drinks. Doors open a half hour before show start time. To reserve tickets or for more information, visit parisharts.square.site or call 978-692-6333 or email admin@pcawestford.org. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. Back to the Eagle Tribune. Hudson man killed in Pelham crash. Pelham, an 81-year-old Hudson man, died Monday night after his vehicle collided with a utility pole on Keys Hill Road. Around 4:30 p.m., police and fire departments responded to the area of 27 Keys Hill Road for reports of a single motor vehicle crash into a utility pole with live wires down on the vehicle, fire officials said. When first responders arrived, they found the lone occupant of the vehicle unconscious, in serious condition, and entrapped inside his 2008 Lincoln MKZ. Liberty Utilities was contacted to cut power to the area before first responders could attempt to extricate the man. After 19 minutes of significant extrication efforts, the occupant was removed from the vehicle, provided advanced life support care, and transported to a local area hospital with life-threatening injuries. He later succumbed to his injuries and was pronounced dead Monday evening. Keys Hill Road was closed between the areas of Mammoth and Castle Hill Roads from the time of the incident until around 6:30 a.m. Tuesday morning, as crews worked to restore power to the area and clean up the scene. Pelham Police and Fire Departments were assisted by the Hudson Police Department. The investigation is ongoing. Susan.
Thank you. Back to the Sun. In Lowell, local groups receive climate workforce grants through MassCEC. More than 60 organizations across the state were awarded grant funding by the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center last month from a pool of $27 million to bolster clean energy job training. Governor Maura Healey announced the funding at the Greater Lawrence Technical High School in Andover, November 21. This funding will give thousands of residents the training and support they need to start good-paying careers in these cutting-edge industries, said Healy. It's an investment in our people and in the long-term strength of our economy. The grant funding is meant to support training programs, career awareness initiatives, and business development efforts for more than 13,000 people and hundreds of businesses across Massachusetts over the next 3 years. Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll said the funding will give communities across Massachusetts the support they need to help residents build new skills, explore new interests, and find real opportunities in this burgeoning industry. It will strengthen local training programs and create clear pathways to meaningful careers that strengthen our communities and our state's economy, said Driscoll. The $27 million was distributed to 67 organizations operating six types of programs: equity workforce training implementation, climate critical workforce training, equipment and infrastructure, climate critical underrepresented business support, equity workforce planning and capacity, student and young adult career awareness and training, and the Massachusetts Climate Career Fund. Two of the grant recipients operate out of Lowell, both of which were awarded for the student and young adult career awareness and training category. The Mass Hire Lowell Young Adult Career Center will receive $150,000 to build up capacity and support the further development of its clean energy career exploration program. That program is aimed at providing young adults with hands-on exposure to possible career paths in the clean energy sector in collaboration with Interplay Learning. Project Learn, a Lowell-based nonprofit, will receive $50,000 in grant funding for the planning and design of the pilot for its Renewable Futures Lab, a planned hands-on summer course for youth in Lowell to prepare for careers in the clean energy sector. Another organization, Building Mass Careers, is also receiving $50,000 under the Equity Workforce Planning and Capacity category to create a pre-apprenticeship program to serve low-income individuals in underrepresented communities in Greater Lowell and the Metro North regions. The Heart of New England Council for Scouting America will also receive funding through this round, with $40,000 going to the group to incorporate clean energy and climate-critical career exploration through merit badge pathways by working with the school districts in Fitchburg, Leominster, and Worcester. The aim, Mass CEC said in a statement November 21 is to help expand training and upskilling opportunities for residents, provide hands-on career exposure for students and young adults, fund equipment and facility upgrades that strengthen training programs, and increase support for underrepresented businesses in the clean energy sector. With over 115,000 clean energy workers in Massachusetts, we need to expand opportunities to support a strong, skilled workforce for the future, said Energy and Environmental Affairs Secretary Rebecca Tepper. These programs connect residents with hands-on experience, industry partnerships, and real pathways to jobs that are in demand. Mass CEC Interim CEO Dr. Jennifer LeBlond said the funding and the job training it supports will go on to help lower energy costs, protect communities, and improve quality of life. These 67 organizations, ranging from technical schools to unions, are growing a diverse pipeline of talent and setting workers on the path to successful, sustainable careers. This is what equitable workforce development looks like, creating access, opportunity, and investment, said LeBlond. Back to you, Jean-Luc.
Thank you, Susan. Justice will prevail if Americans demand it. Federal judges have thrown out dozens of cases brought by the Trump administration, from free speech violations to lack of due process. The same judges have been under attack with threats of impeachment. The chief law enforcement of the United States has taken marching orders from the executive on prosecuting political enemies, a threat to the longstanding independence of courts. Congress has been ignored or insulted when it challenges the Attorney General or the Homeland Security Chief, who refuses to answer questions. Never before has there been such an assault on America's judicial system, the branch that holds all other parts of the democratic government together when enforcement of law is established with the consent of the governed. President Donald Trump has spoken clearly about his intent with actions he has taken weaponizing the judicial system, retribution, and revenge against political enemies, regardless of the legitimacy of the cases. When the established and credible U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia refused to file charges against former FBI Director William Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James, Tom forced out the veteran attorney and replaced him with a White House aide with no prosecutorial experience. As a result, newly appointed U.S. Attorney Lindsey Halligan botched the Comey case with a number of missteps, including not showing the amended charges to the grand jury before putting them before a judge. But the judge also recently ruled that Halligan's appointment was not valid and for now has dismissed the cases. The attacks on the judiciary and unprecedented rejection and ignoring of court orders started with the Trump administration's illegal transport of immigrants to an El Salvador prison. The cases of convicting and punishing without due process are too numerous to state. Recently, Trump directed Attorney General Pam Bondi to begin investigations against Democratic Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, who was in the Navy and a U.S. astronaut, for telling members of the military they did not have to follow illegal orders. Kelly, with five other senator-former military and CIA officers, posted a video telling military personnel they didn't have to follow illegal orders and instead to follow their constitutional oath. In another case, Trump ordered Bond to investigate Democrats Bill Clinton and Lawrence Summers for their role in the Epstein cases as a backdoor way of keeping the Epstein files out of public view. Some judges have decided to fight back. Judge Mark Wolf, a 50-year veteran of the court, recently stepped down from his position as a federal judge, saying he could no longer remain silent about the abuses of the justice system by Trump. In the end, this is not a battle between Trump and the judiciary. It's an attack on the American people's power of self-governance. It should be defended at all costs. Members of Congress have a role in this as representatives of the people. They should be standing up to defend and preserve our justice system. Without justice, there is no democracy. This piece originated with Mankato, Minnesota Free Press, a sister CNHI publication to the Eagle Tribune. The editorial board concurs with the sentiment of this piece. why it matters. The Trump administration is attacking U.S. traditional system with impunity. And that's just at the end of that. Okay, Susan.
Thank you. Back to the Sun. In Woburn, man charged in ATM blast. Police say suspect tracked news about October explosion. Boston Herald. A Massachusetts man has been indicted for allegedly blowing up an ATM in Greater Boston, with an initial forensic examination of his phone showing that he searched for articles about the explosion from local news outlets. Christopher Silva, 43, of Stoneham, remains in custody after being arrested in late October in connection with the early September incident in Woburn. He's slated to be arraigned in federal court next week. A federal grand jury indicted Silva on November 20 on one count of maliciously damaging by means of an explosive real property used in and affecting interstate commerce, which carries a sentence of at least 5 years in prison. Silva could also face up to 3 years of supervised release and a fine of up to $250,000. The explosion at an Eastern Bank in Woburn unfolded in the early morning hours of September 4, when surveillance footage captured a suspect, whom authorities later identified as Silva, approaching an exterior ATM at about 4:12 a.m. Silva could be seen wearing a blue balaclava, yellow glasses, a black jumpsuit with orange markings, a black and gray backpack, and dark-colored sneakers with red markings, according to authorities and charging documents. In their surveillance footage, State Trooper Michael P. Callahan wrote in an affidavit in support of a criminal complaint, Silva can be seen walking up to the left side of the ATM and placing a brown or tan-colored object on the bottom right corner of the ATM. The object then begins to emit smoke, and Silva can be seen running away. Several seconds later, the object explodes, the trooper added. The explosion caused a significant damage to the frame and the lower right section of the ATM. Investigators recovered some of the clothing and a walking stick that Silva was seen wearing and carrying in the surveillance footage in a parking lot accessible on foot from the Eastern Bank ATM that exploded. Other items were recovered in trash bags just days after the incident on September 8. A forensic scientist with the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab collected DNA from Silva's blue balaclava and yellow glasses, later linking the samples to the man's DNA profile. Authorities also seized and searched Silva's cell phone with a forensic examination ongoing. In his affidavit to support the criminal complaint, Callahan wrote that the results from an initial examination showed Silva's Google Chrome search history included two articles about the Eastern Bank ATM explosion. One article was by NBC Boston, and the second article was on Patch.com and had the title, Lone Bomber Blows Up Woburn ATM. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. More Eagle Tribune. Letters to the editor. Trump's dark vision for America coming true. Clearing away paper stacks, I came to an October/November 2024, the Progressive magazine. Prior to that significant voting time for U.S., for us, came this article, Trump's Dark Vision for America. Artwork has him diabolical with dominoes lined up, ready to fall, finger ready to push. Listing the topics, dark vision of America, mass deportation, political purges, Big Brother in the classroom, Big Brother everywhere, magnifying higher education, wreck the economy, bring back whooping cough, diphtheria, chicken pox, polio, and more for our chastened children, reverse efforts to address climate change and medication abortion and all reproductive choice worldwide, and make LGBTQ plus people disappear. Outlaw gender-affirming health care, do nothing about gun violence except make it worse, order mass executions, eliminate the Department of Education and teachers' unions, create a government of hardcore Trump loyalists, and end representative democracy. Now we see and feel the end of his first year. How's he doing? His plummeting approval numbers tell much. Maybe the dark vision out of his melancholic old head will get us all ready to vote. 2026 midterms, including our youngest eligible, so they may yet shake their adult years world. Else, we'll see symbolic as well real his selfish destruction of our White House's West Wing. This is from Lynn Rudman Chong from Samberton, New Hampshire. Susan.
Thank you, John. Luke, back to the Sun editorial. Ballot measure would transform primary elections. Proposed Massachusetts referendum questions wending their way through the qualifying process for the 2026 state ballot represents some interesting possibilities. One would lower the state income tax rate from 5% to 4%. Another would trigger more frequent refunds from excess tax collections, while another would subject the governor's office and the state legislature to the mandates of the public records law. But one really strikes at the heart of the democratic process, creating an all-party state primary. Supporters of that ballot question gathered on the State House steps Monday before delivering tens of thousands of signatures to officials for certification. If the question were to pass next fall, all candidates for a statewide race would appear on a single primary ballot. Any voter, no matter the party affiliation, could cast a ballot for the candidate of their choice, as opposed to the current system in which voters must choose within their registered party or select one specific party ballot if they're independent and registered as unenrolled. Proponents contend that it creates a fairer and more open system. Healthy democracies mean choice. It means every voter's vote matters. It means no voter is taken for granted, said Celia Johnston Blue, CEO of the Massachusetts Woman of Color Coalition. The question's supporters point to other states, both red and blue, that already implement all-party primaries, including California, Alaska, and Louisiana, each of which has reported an uptick in both election competition and voter participation. Actually, it's not that novel a concept. Municipal elections in Massachusetts employ a similar system where unaffiliated candidates run for office on a single ballot. Across the state, voters in Massachusetts believe that we can do better, said Jesse Littlewood, a political strategist and campaign manager of the Coalition for Healthy Democracy. The Secretary of State will officially certify newly submitted ballot signatures this week, determining which move on to the next round of consideration. According to an NPR report in September 2023, the movement to update the primary election process has been gaining momentum across the nation. Reform-minded advocates and many political scientists agree that the present system isn't working. That's because a relatively small number of voters are selecting their party's nominee, often in a district or state that leans strongly toward one party, which usually means that whoever wins the primary cruises to victory in a general election. That's a scenario often repeated in Massachusetts elections. The group Unite America underscored what it terms the primary problem with this startling statistic. In 2020, only 10% of eligible Americans nationwide cast ballots in primary elections that effectively decided the winners in a supermajority, 83%, of congressional seats. A microcosm of that dynamic plays out in this state in virtually every municipal election. For example, in the city of Lowell's preliminary election held in September, only 9% of registered voters participated. The general election wasn't much better, when just shy of only 11% of the electorate voted. Experts and advocates say the primary election process excludes voters and leads to more extreme candidates who mainly appeal to activists and could be exacerbating partisan polarization. That's why there's a movement to rethink how states set up their primary elections and how voters choose which candidates advance to a general election. The modern-day party primaries in the U.S. originated about 100 years ago, according to Kevin Kosar, senior fellow at a right-leaning think tank called the American Enterprise Institute. He says the earlier system was often riddled with corruption, and party primaries were created to give voters a say in who got on their ballots. Jeremy Gruber, senior vice president of the advocacy group Open Primaries, says at first political parties were not happy with this change. Parties decided to make peace with primary elections, he says, and rather than fight them, they began to claim primaries were theirs, not the voters. That's why at the beginning most primary elections were closed, meaning you had to be registered with a party to participate. Gruber says initially these primaries worked well because almost everybody was either a Democrat or Republican. But as we've witnessed in Massachusetts, over the past few decades, more voters now identify as independent and have registered as unenrolled. In fact, according to the Massachusetts Secretary of State's office, as of February, unenrolled voters represented the vast majority of the electorate, 65%, compared to 26% for Democrats and just 8% Republicans. What's happened is the electorate has gone through a massive sea change over the last 25 years, Gruber said. Now, independents are the largest and fastest growing group of voters in the country. Over 50% of our young people, millennials and Gen Z voters, are independent. This is at least partly why many states have moved away from closed primaries. Only 16 states, including Massachusetts, Florida, and New York, still have either completely or partially closed primaries. As with the long-delayed update of its public records law, progressive Massachusetts again finds itself behind the curve of a popular reform. The state's Democrat-dominated political machine won't like it, but a vote for open primaries, should it appear on the 2026 state ballot, would ensure a more inclusive, competitive political process. Back to you, Jean-Luc.
Thank you, Susan. Another letter to the editor. Dangers of climate change on the White Mountains. I love the White Mountains. I've hiked them more times than I can count. I read the article, Scientists Show the Reality of Climate Change in the Whites, November 27, Eagle Tribune, with great interest. It explains the development of the White Mountains Almanac, but provides few conclusions. For example, how much shorter is the ski season now compared to 30 years ago? How many days is it too hot to go hiking in the summer or even spring or fall? Creating and publishing the almanac is an important endeavor, and it contains tons of data. However, it is somewhat technical and does not do a great job of describing the big picture. One must do a thorough read to get it. For example, winter temperatures have increased nearly 6 degrees since the 1950s. On the other hand, there are 4 to 5 more days with thunderstorms every summer. These and other changes affect how we recreate in the Whites, but more importantly, the changes affect the flora and fauna far more significantly. I urge you to read the almanac itself and learn about how our addiction to fossil fuel affect both the natural world and our own lives. You can find it online at https://mountwashington.org/research/the-white-mountains-almanac/. This is from Jonathan Quint of Goffstown. Susan.
Thank you, John. Look back to the Sun. Officer recalls confronting Mangione during search in New York, the Associated Press. A Pennsylvania police officer responding to a tip from the manager of a McDonald's testified Tuesday about confronting Luigi Mangione during the intense manhunt last year for UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson's killer. As soon as Mangione doffed his medical mask at the restaurant in Altoona, Pennsylvania, Officer Joseph Detweiler said, "I knew he was the suspect whose face had been all over the news since the shooting 5 days earlier on a Manhattan sidewalk. It's him, I'm not kidding. He's real nervous, and he didn't talk too much." Detweiler told a supervisor by phone from the restaurant parking lot moments after meeting Mangione, according to the officer's body camera video. It was played in court Tuesday, the second day of a hearing about evidence in the case. Mangione indeed said little initially to Detweiler and another officer, giving only what turned out to be a false name, home state, and driver's license. But Detweiler testified that he noticed the man's fingers shaking as they interacted and officers patted him down. Over the ensuing minutes, Mangione placidly ate a hash brown as the officers waited for colleagues and claimed they were simply responding to loitering concerns at the eatery. "I was trying to keep him calm," Detweiler told the court, adding that he at one point started whistling over the restaurant's holiday season music to make him think that nothing was different about this call than any other call. Lawyers for Mangione, 27, want to block prosecutors from showing or telling jurors at his eventual Manhattan trial about statements he allegedly made and items authorities said they seized from his backpack during his arrest. The objects include a 9mm handgun that prosecutors say matches the one used in the killing and a notebook in which they say Mangione described his intent to whack a health insurance executive. The defense contends the items should be excluded because police didn't get a warrant before searching Mangione's backpack. They also want to suppress some statements he made to law enforcement personnel, such as allegedly giving a false name because officers started asking questions before telling him he had a right to remain silent. The laws concerning how police interact with potential suspects before reading their rights or obtaining search warrants are complex and often disputed in criminal cases. In Mangione's case, crucial questions will include whether he believed he was free to leave at the point when he spoke to the arresting officers and whether there were exigent circumstances that merited searching his backpack before getting a warrant. Detweiler testified that he never told Mangione he couldn't leave, nor mentioned the New York shooting. Defense lawyers, however, have argued in court filings that officers strategically stood in a way that prevented him from leaving. Mangione, the Ivy League-educated scion of a wealthy Maryland family, has pleaded not guilty to state and federal murder charges. The state charges carry the possibility of life in prison, while federal prosecutors are seeking the death penalty. Neither trial has been scheduled. Mangione's lawyers want to bar evidence from both cases, but this week's hearing pertains only to the state case. Manhattan prosecutors haven't yet laid out their arguments for allowing the disputed evidence. Their federal counterparts have said in court filings that police were justified in searching the backpack to ensure there was no dangerous items and that Mangione's statements to officers were voluntary and made before he was under arrest. Five witnesses testified on Monday, including a Pennsylvania prison officer who said Mangione told him that when arrested, he had a backpack with foreign currency and a 3D-printed pistol. Surveillance video showed a masked gunman shooting Thompson from behind as the executive walked to a Midtown Manhattan hotel for his company's annual investor conference on December 4, 2024. Prosecutors say delay, deny, depose were written on the ammunition, mimicking a phrase insurance industry critics use to describe how companies avoid paying claims. Thompson, 50, worked at the giant United Health Group for 20 years and became CEO of its insurance arm in 2021. He was married and had children who were in high school. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. A more uplifting story. One last shot. Whittier plays Dimon tonight for state VOC title. Last Wednesday night, the Whittier Tech football team was stunned when their rivals, Greater Lawrence, pulled off a near-miraculous comeback, scoring three touchdowns in the last minute and 44 seconds, or just 104 seconds, funny way to look at it, to come away with an exhilarating 45-40 Thanksgiving Eve victory. That was, for all intents and purposes, the Reggie Super Bowl. Come this Wednesday night, a rejuvenated Wildcats team will be playing for their Super Bowl, the Mass State Vocational Large School State Championship game against Dimmock Voc of Fall River at Medford's Hormel Field starting at 6 p.m. Whittier, which lost in last year's Voc final by 38-0 decision to a three-time champs Bay Path, are no longer licking its wounds and are prepared to take home a state title. We had the 24-hour rule, said Whittier head coach Kevin Bradley, whose team is 8-3. We were down for a day after blowing that game. We have moved on to our next game, which is Dimmock. We've already had two great practices. Dimmock comes into the game with an 8-3 record, although they could have 9 wins, but had to forfeit the victory against Old Colony because of an ineligible player. The 7th win of the season came 2 weeks ago against the same Greater Lawrence team, 21-20. It was Dimmock which came away with the thrilling comeback victory and the state semifinal. Their defensive line is big and strong, said Bradley. They shut Greater Lawrence down. We'll need a team effort to move them. Whittier's offense hasn't been a problem. The Wildcats have scored 348 points this season, averaging 29 a game with their double wing attack. Noah Allen has been immense this season with 25 touchdowns and 1,362 rushing yards. He gets help from several teammates, including Jay Vasquez, Grady Booth, and Elijah Jones, who have combined to score 16 touchdowns and rush for over 1,200 yards. Quarterback Mike Nealon, who only throws 1 or 2 passes a game, can also move the chains with his quick feet and overall athleticism. We have to keep the ball away from their offense by having long drives and eating up the clock so they can't have the football, said Bradley. Plus, we need to finish our drives. While the offense will be tested against the Bengals' big defensive line, it's a Wildcat defense which will most likely decide the outcome. Demon likes to throw, and throw a lot, with quarterback Logan McKenzie, and a favorite target, his brother James McKenzie, while Alexi Gonzalez is the team's featured back. Demon is a very powerful team with a dynamic quarterback and a very dangerous wide receiver that can take a short pass and turn it into a long run, said Bradley. To win, we need to shut down the quarterback from making big plays. He has a knack for making something simply go big. Whittier will be looking for its third state Voc championship, beating Dean Tech in 2005 and Blackstone in 2014. The Wildcats defeated Bristol, Plymouth in overtime, and Essex Tech to reach the final, while Dimmock topped off Greater Lawrence. Dimmock also dominated Bristol, Plymouth 41-7 back in October. Susan.
Thank you. Back to the Sun. Democratic U.S. Senator Mark Warner launches a bid for re-election in Richmond, Virginia. Democratic U.S. Senator Mark Warner announced his bid for re-election on Tuesday, launching what will be a key campaign in a narrowly divided Senate. In a campaign announcement, the Virginia senator said he was running for re-election to rein in America's economic crisis, particularly regarding the impact of artificial intelligence on job displacement. We need a vision to chart a new path and effective leadership to get it done, Warner said. That's why I am running for re-election to the United States Senate. Republicans have a 53-47 majority in the Senate, according to the Cook Political Report. Warner represents a solidly Democratic seat. Warner, a businessman who co-founded the company that became Nextel, served as governor of Virginia from 2002 to 2006. He was first elected in 2008 to the Senate, where he now serves as the vice chairman of the Select Committee on Intelligence. Warner nodded to his business success while pitching himself as a candidate best suited to tackle AI. This moment calls for big ideas, Warner said. The tech companies that displace jobs for AI should actually help pay for the solutions. We need universal health care coverage and a complete overhaul of affordable housing and child care. On the Republican side, State Sen Bryce Reeves had already announced a campaign for the seat. Reeves, an Army veteran and former law enforcement officer, has served in the Virginia Senate for over a decade. Democratic U.S. Senator Tim Kaine, Virginia's other senator, was reelected in 2024 and will not be on the ballot in 2026. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. More Eagle Tribune. Merrimack Hoops opens MAAC schedule with a bang. North Andover. The Merrimack men's basketball team will open its MAAC schedule on Thursday night at Lawler Arena, where the Warriors are planning a handful of special promotions, including a T-shirt giveaway designed to match their new powder blue third jerseys. Merrimack returns home after a three-game swing in Philadelphia at the Cathedral Classic. The Warriors stumbled out of the gate with two losses, but salvaged a trip with a win over LaSalle on Sunday. The early story for Merrimack has been the emergence of several fresh faces. Ernest Shelton, a Division II transfer, leads the team with 16.6 points per game and is knocking down 38% of his attempts from beyond the arc. Meanwhile, freshman guard Kaver Kennedy looks every bit like the next standout guard for the Warriors, and lineage that includes the likes of Bud Clark and Javaris Hayes. The leader now serving as an assistant coach. Kennedy ranks second on the team with 13.8 points per game and sits atop the Warriors' leaderboard with 16 steals. Shelton Kennedy, by the way, played together in high school at Father Judge High in Philadelphia. Merrimack enters the matchup at 3-2 overall, but boasts a 1-0 mark at home, highlighting by a 72-65 victory over Maine 2 weeks ago. Merrimack is noted for its constant pressure on the defensive end. This year, they've improved on the shooting side, particularly beyond the three-point arc. The program has additional promotions scheduled throughout the night. Fans can purchase tickets at the Lala Arena box office or online at Merrimack Athletics, all one word, .com. Susan.
Oh, thank you. Just a short one. Fleet Notebook, Boston to stage a garden party. The Boston Fleet will be docking on Causeway Street this spring. The Professional Women's Hockey League Club announced Tuesday morning that the team will host the Montreal Victory at TD Garden on April 11 at 7 p.m. The game was originally listed on Boston's schedule with a time and location to be determined, but the Fleet will play its first game on garden ice against a longtime Boston rival. And, This marks a special milestone in our club's history, said Fleet General Manager Danielle Marmer. The Boston-Montreal rivalry runs quite deep on the men's side, but we found a way to continue that in the PWHL as well. I expect this to be a really fun game for our fans to attend and one that's going to mean a lot in terms of standings and just to continue on that rivalry. Thank you for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Visit our website where you can tune in to LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Susan and John Luke. Thank you for listening.